We're open for business live.
Good morning, I'm Jamie Veitch. I'm your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we're broadcasting live from Sheffield Live's radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. We're going out on 93.2 FM. We're also going out through our internet live stream. And however you're listening, the programme will also be available as a podcast later on from the Sheffield Live website. Talking about podcasts, last week's programme featured a double header. We had mentor and mentee in the studio. Charles and Ben came along to talk about how the process of mentoring works, how Ben, at the start of his career, has sought out mentorship from Charles, who has had a successful career for several decades now. And how does Ben benefit from mentoring from Charles? How did he find Charles to mentor him? What does Charles do as a mentor? And Charles, from Charles's perspective, how Charles helps people that he mentors, and what does he do if people don't take his advice? So that was a fascinating discussion. It was great to have them both in the studio talking that through. And of course, if you didn't hear that, then you can catch it on the podcast. Also on the show last week, we had Gillian Kowalchuk, and she's launched a new business, launching a new app called Safe in the City, which will overlay data on top of map data, so you can take a look at information about places within a city, look at where places have been reported to people feeling unsafe, and really interesting in terms of the process that she's been through to bring that product to market, how she's done that, and her experiences of working in tech. So if you didn't hear last week's programme with Gillian Kowalchuk and also Charles and Ben, then catch it on the podcast section of the Sheffield Live website. Go to sheffieldlive.org, look at radio shows, find Business Live, and the programme from the 1st of December is there. But that was then, and this is now. What's on today? Well, really pleased that Jay Bayani is on the programme again, because she comes in every few weeks or so to give us an update on what's going on in employment law and what you need to know if you're an employer. So whether you work with employees, with workers, or with self-employed people, the law changes and case law comes to pass in terms of how the law is interpreted. And Jay has an update, and it's crucial to know what's going on. So that's on the programme this morning. Also on the show, well, it was the Sheffield Business Awards last night. Were you there? Were you dancing until 2 in the morning? If you were, well, I might have seen you there myself. Seemed like a good evening. Lots of people enjoying themselves. And congratulations, of course, to everyone who was shortlisted and the winners. And we have an interview that we recorded last year with John Johnson of Reach Homes. And I think it's a timely spot to play that interview once again. We haven't played it since then because John last night was revealed as a winner of one of the awards at the Sheffield Business Awards. So we're going to find out more about Reach Homes by playing that interview with John later on in the programme to remind us what Reach Homes is all about. But before we do that, what's been going on? What else has been going on? Well, the taxi firm Uber has had its license suspended in Sheffield after the council said that Uber had failed to respond to requests about the management of the company. And Uber has been fighting a ban in London anyway. It's going to be allowed to operate until the 18th of December, and it will then be able to appeal against the decision. But the decision taken by the council centres around what it said was the company's failure to change the name of on its licence from that of the former chief exec in the UK, who actually has left Uber, Jo Bertram. She'd announced her departure after Transport for London said that Uber would not have its licence continued there. So Sheffield City Council spokesperson has been quoted saying that Uber's licence was suspended and it's legally allowed to operate up to the 18th of December. If it chooses to appeal the suspension, it can continue to operate until the appeal is heard. And an Uber spokesman has put out in a release that the firm has informed Sheffield City Council that they would need to change the name on their licence, and that this is an administrative error, so that they hope can be quickly resolved. So watch this space. What else going on in Sheffield? The Real Junk Food Project, which takes food otherwise destined to be to go into landfill and uses it to create wonderful meals at their pay-as-you-feel cafes, and also food for the Steeplehouse warehouse, where you can go and collect food. They've been shortlisted for a national award. Now, I was really pleased to hear about this. The Real Junk Food Project have been on my programme, on this programme, in the past. And the organisation that's shortlisted them for a national award is an organisation that I've done some work with in London called Responsible Finance. I wasn't involved in the judging in any way. So when they told me that Real Junk Food Project are shortlisted, it was great to know that. So they've been shortlisted in the City Micro Entrepreneurship Awards. They are one of four finalists in their category, but they have to wait now until the 20th of March next year to find out whether or not they're a winner. But great accolade for them, great recognition of the work that they've done. So plenty of other exciting things are going on in business and in social enterprise in Sheffield. But before we look at what else is going on, time now to play our first interview. And Jay Bowerney came into the radio studio on Wednesday of this week to give me an update on what was going on in business and social enterprise employment law. We'll hear from Jay right now.
Okay, morning Jay, thanks very much for joining us once again in the Sheffield Live radio studio. How are you?
I'm very good, and morning to you, Jamie.
So what's been going on? What are the latest developments in employment law that people running businesses or social enterprises need to be aware of?
So I think since I last came on, we've had a budget, and there are a couple of things that arise from that. Nothing too dramatic in terms of employing people, apart from the usual minimum wage rises from April. So all employers obviously need to know what the new minimum wage rises are.
Yep.
Those are widely publicised, so they just do a Google search and those figures will come up. And making sure that if you've got a payroll provider, that they know who's on minimum wage and that they need to pay them the right amount.
Yes, indeed.
The only other thing really that I wanted to mention was that I don't know if you're aware that there's this this sort of confusion over employment status when it comes to the test for determining whether somebody's employed or self-employed or a worker. And we've talked quite a lot about this before.
We have, indeed.
But unfortunately, it's very difficult for businesses to know how to apply the test correctly because employment law suggests a different test to HMRC. And so that's caused a lot of confusion. So the government has now stated that they will be publishing some clarification of how these employment status tests should be conducted, because that's just so topical at the moment.
And right. Yes, it is, absolutely. Yeah. And clarity will be welcomed there, presumably. I mean, if HMRC are applying different standards or a different measure to what determines that than employment law, that's really, really very confusing, isn't it?
Yeah, and they're subtle differences,
right,
but they can make a massive difference in terms of how you should tax somebody who you believe is self-employed, but on the other hand, how you should treat somebody if you believe they're self-employed from an employment law point of view, because you don't want to end up in the unfortunate position of these companies like Uber and Deliveroo and Pimlico Plumbers, the big ones that we've talked about before.
Indeed.
And having to be subject to a finding that actually they do have some employment rights.
No, quite. Okay, so when will the clarity, or the clarifications rather, when are those like to be published?
I don't know. There's no timeline as far as I'm aware. There's just a a statement that that is to come.
Ah, yes, it's a standard approach by government, isn't it? We will be publishing some clarifications.
Yes.
But we don't know when.
And really, it's an extension of the Taylor Report, because the Taylor Report's already, of course, done quite a lot of work on this whole employer status issue. But the next thing I wanted to cover really is a bit of an extension from that, but a real blow to many businesses who take on self-employed people. So this is the case that's just been reported of King and Sash Windows. And Sash Windows had an individual who they believed was self-employed and treated him as a self-employed person. Didn't allow him any paid holiday, quite rightly. On challenging this, the tribunal found that he was actually a worker, and so he was therefore entitled to statutory minimum 5.6 weeks holiday a year, which is what the entitlement under the working time regulations is. However, the interesting thing here was that the regulations also say that holiday that hasn't been taken within a current holiday year will be lost.
Yes.
And therefore the impact of losing a challenge like this was fairly short, not completely devastating to a business, because English law suggests that you can only go back a matter of 3 months for recovery.
Right, okay.
And there are some cases that talk about a sort of two-year recovery period, but there was a timeline on it. However, this particular case has thrown all of that into confusion, because what this determined was that there's an anomaly between EU law and English law, and therefore the normal time limits shouldn't apply, which means that actually holiday pay claims could date back all the way to 1996.
Good grief.
Yeah, when the EU directive was first introduced. So that is going to cause yet more worry to those big companies in the spotlight, such as Uber and Pimlico Plumbers and Deliveroo, but also businesses that, you know, we deal with day in, day out, that take on people on a self-employed basis.
Yes. So a business that has people that it believes to be on a self-employed basis, but are actually workers, liable to pay holiday, and that the three-month limit won't apply anymore. It can be backdated all the way as far as 1996. Now, if a business has got this wrong, that could be devastating for the business. Businesses presumably could go out of business. This individual, presumably in this case, will be entitled to that holiday.
Yeah.
Will this go to appeal, to further appeal?
Yeah, I believe that it will. And these things, we're never getting to a finite conclusion on these. It's an ever rolling program. So I don't know how scary, you know, how realistic this will be, but certainly at the moment, employers need to really be aware. So the things that they need to put in practice are getting the right contracts in place, always the starting point. You know, create the right contract for the relationship that you're dealing with. Checking that the arrangements within the workplace for employees, workers and self-employed people are different.
So
if you treat them all the same, then there's a chance that you won't be able to make that distinction between them in law when you're not making that distinction in practice.
I see. Okay.
Okay. And take advice if you're not sure, because it really is a potential ground for, you know, pitfalls for employers that could be disastrous, particularly for smaller employers.
It could indeed, yes, quite clearly. Okay, so get that right from the outset and take advice, and consider how you differentiate in terms of fair treatment of workers, self-employed people and employees. Okay, crucial lessons there. Thank you, Jay.
Then this another very interesting case that's just been reported is about a Jewish teacher who was a young woman who was sacked for living in sin, and she's just won her discrimination claims.
So sacked by a school that she was teaching?
Yes, and it was I think it was a Jewish school, but what the judge said was that the managers in this case were seeking to impress upon this young woman their own system of beliefs in really quite an unacceptable way. And so the interesting thing here was that she won her direct and indirect religious discrimination claims, but also one, a sex discrimination and harassment claim, on the basis that the managers wouldn't have treated her in such a bullish way. I think their defence was that they were being maternalistic and they were being nurturing, but it was held that actually they were being really quite bullying, and they wouldn't have done that had she been a man.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, multifaceted discrimination.
Yes.
Case.
And so she's won her case?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So she was teaching in a state-maintained school, do we know?
I don't know if it was state-maintained or not.
It was a faith school.
A faith school, yeah. And although she was from a Jewish background, she wasn't. She said she considered herself to be a practicing Jew, but not an Orthodox Jew. And this was an Orthodox Jewish environment, and so they were really pushing their beliefs on her.
Were they? Yes.
Yeah. Which in a workplace, you know, you can only go so far in doing that before it steps into the realms of harassment.
Yes,
and discrimination.
Okay, an interesting one there.
Yeah. And then a couple of ACAS guidelines that might be worth looking at that have just been published on sexual harassment and on mental health. So these are both very topical areas at the moment.
Yep, they certainly are.
We've run some training sessions recently on both areas that were fully booked. People are very interested in making sure that they get this right.
Mm, I'm sure.
Both from a protecting the business point of view and from, you know, wanting to do the right thing by their employees.
Yes.
Point of view. So that's all, you know, that really needs to be done. And on sexual harassment, of course, I think since I was last on, there's been all the press about Harvey Weinstein.
Yes, indeed.
So I've written quite a lot of articles and done quite a lot of speaking on how we prevent some of those issues happening within our own businesses, and there are steps that you can put in place.
Hmm.
And the Christmas party is a classic.
Well, it is, isn't it? Alcohol and people losing their inhibitions, and it can be a scene in which all sorts of inappropriate behaviour takes place.
Yep, and I've certainly worked in workplaces where, you know, it was common practice for, you know, the legal profession is not a good example of a safe working environment quite often, particularly back in the day, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was worse, I think. But it still goes on. So just thinking about your staff Christmas parties, you have to be careful as an employer, because although it's a social occasion, it's an extension of the workplace.
Yes.
And so you can still be liable for the actions of your employees.
Right.
So a few tips, really. First of all, taking preventative action is the only form of defence that an employer has to a harassment or a discrimination claim.
Right, okay.
And preventative action involves a number of things. So first of all, making sure that the culture of the organisation is right. So if you if your managers and your directors are behaving inappropriately, then, you know, that's not giving the right example to people you know, further down the kind of hierarchy. Training is a really, really good way. Equality and diversity training is a good way to show that you've taken concrete preventative action and will help in any defence to a claim. Dealing with complaints consistently and taking them seriously.
Yeah.
Having an open dialogue, not a culture of fear. Having a sexual harassment policy is really important.
Yes.
and adhering to that. Some businesses have a harassment champion or staff representative dealing with those issues, so that it's easier for an individual who feels that they've been a victim to go and approach somebody that they know will, you know, has got some understanding of what the issues are and will know what to do next. And then, of course, in the worst case scenario, police action. I've heard of a Christmas party, again, sadly, in the legal profession, some years ago, where a staff member was raped by a partner, and yet nobody everybody had heard that that had happened. Nobody had reported it to the police.
Good grief.
Which is appalling.
It's horrifying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely horrifying. So this is all about preventative action. This is about a culture. This is about steps that you should be taking in your business anyway. Mm-hmm. And you need to have this in place in any case, quite aside from the fact that you're having a Christmas party or any other parties or social occasions that are extensions of the workplace too.
Yes.
Yeah. So you've written quite a lot about this. You've spoken quite a lot about this as well.
Yes.
And it's something you talked about diversity and equality training as well. Appropriate steps, appropriate procedures in place as well, an appropriate culture. Now, are you finding, Jay, that more and more employers are coming to you and saying, have we got this right? We hope we are doing the right thing. We hope we have appropriate policies in place. But we have noticed how there is much more attention given to this. We want to check that we're doing this right. Has there been an increase in businesses coming to you and organisations saying, have we got this right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So we've been delivering our training, which we call Unconscious Bias Equality and Diversity Training, because we're all under much more of a spotlight. And because there's been all this press attention to it, there are more individuals who feel more empowered, quite rightly. And there's the hashtag Me Too campaign, which has been very, very widespread. And so more and more, usually women, but not always, are speaking out about their experiences.
Yes.
So, of course, employers are making sure that they've taken the right steps to limit any damage and to do the right thing by their employees. So training is the absolute best way to show a paper trail that you've taken those issues seriously, you've trained people on.
Right, yes, so training is absolutely crucial in this. And of course, people can find out more details at your website of the training that you offer, but they can also read some of the blogs that you've written about this and articles about this there too.
Yes, some practical steps we've tried to set out that all businesses can put in place, and those that want training, we can make that quite bespoke to the business. So depending on what sector or the size of the organisation, you can really make it very practical and applicable to the managers and staff that you want to train.
Okay, super, thank you. Great. Now, it's winter, potentially snow, maybe even snow by the time this interview is broadcast, and getting to work or getting to your place of work in adverse weather. Things that employers need to think about here as well, aren't there?
Mm. Well, I mean, I hate the snow. I'm really not a fan of the winter, and I'm very happy that I now live quite close to the city centre, so I'm not likely to get stuck anywhere. But of course, lots of people are going to be in a situation where they can't make it into work, and employers need to sort of plan ahead for what they do with adverse weather. So the starting point is to have an adverse weather policy so that it's clear to everybody what the expectations are. We are asked every year by employers and employees, am I entitled to pay if I can't get in because the weather's bad? Well, the answer to that is no, unless you have an adverse weather policy in your organisation that states that you will be, which is unlikely.
Right.
So it's up to an individual to make sure that they can get into work. But some practical things that an employer can do is to set out things such as having a degree of flexibility, who you should ring or contact if you, and at what point if you think you're not going to make it in. Most of us these days have the facility to use IT in a way that enables us to continue to do our job outside of the actual workplace, but not all. You know, it depends what job you're doing. So using technology wisely, and if you plan ahead and you've got a policy in place, then you know you can think about how you might do that, particularly where you're working in a sector where it's critical that you're physically there, that's going to be much more problematic. But in lots of workplaces now, you could work around it.
Yes. Okay. So it depends on the nature of the work, of course, as you say, and whether your physical presence at certain workplaces is necessary or not.
Yes.
But this is about having an appropriate policy in place so that people understand how this will work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, it's been a really eventful year for employment law in all sorts of ways, with the Taylor Review, of course, the case law, the cases that have been heard in courts regarding worker status, self-employment status, employers needing to take action here, and of course we've heard an awful lot and some horrifying cases with regard to harassment too. Thank you so much, Jay, for coming in today and for coming in during the course of the year to share your expertise and your analysis of the changes that have been going on in employment law during the whole course of the year. And people can, of course, find out more about you at your website, and you tweet as well, but you have plenty of information, useful information and articles and how to do it, practical steps, published on the website. So can you give out the website address for us, please?
Yes, thanks, Jamie. It's www.byarneylaw.co.uk, and our Twitter handle is at Byarney Employment Law. There's lots of free resources, as you've said, and it's a good starting point really for businesses or individuals to have a look and see what's going on in employment law and HR.
That's great. That's very helpful. Thank you very much indeed, Jay Byarney.
Thank you.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. That was Jay Byarney. She came into the studio on Wednesday of this week to give us an update on what's been going on in employment law. So if you've only just tuned in and you've missed that, panic not. The podcast of today's programme will be up on the Sheffield Live website from about midday today. What else has been going on in business and in social enterprise this week? Well, Sheffield's One Disco, they're launching an equity raise for a minimum of $10 million to accelerate growth, and the company plans to use proceeds of the share placing to accelerate their growth ambitions. They have increased revenue and decreased costs in 2016. And Chief Executive David Richard was also quoted in the Sheffield Star this week talking about how he wants to inject at least £1 million into education and put something back into the community and put something back to support young people who want a career in tech. So interesting to read that. And as I mentioned earlier, it was the Sheffield Business Awards last night. An awards ceremony was held at Ponds Forge, and it was still going strong at 2 a.m. Now, lots of people celebrating. One of the people celebrating was John Johnson. He runs Strip the Willow, the social enterprise, on the Aberdale Road, and he's also set up Reach Homes, Reach Housing. And he has developed a prototype of what he's described as an eco home using recycled materials and a recycled shipping container. And he thinks that this could be the solution to providing affordable homes for more people. Now, affordable housing is desperately needed, as we know, and we've heard a lot about it in the recent budget. John was surprised to be given one of the awards last night at Sheffield Business Awards, and went up on stage and gave an emotional address to the audience when he accepted the award. I thought it would be a timely opportunity for us to hear an interview that we recorded with John last year. This was recorded in June 2016 when I went along to ask him about the plans for Reach. And so given that they've just picked up this award, let's play this interview with John Johnson of Reach Homes now. John and Jordan, thanks so much for joining me today. So I'm sitting in Strip the Willow in Sheffield, now a fixture on the social enterprise scene in Sheffield, but not the only project that you're involved with. You're through to the final of the Voom pitching.
Semi-final
of the Voom. Yeah. If you get through to the final, then that's when the big bucks start coming in as well.
That's when we actually win something. But,
yeah.
but off to London to share your vision. And it's a vision that you're already making come true in terms of developing a prototype for affordable housing. And it's eco-affordable housing. Now, I'm really, really interested in this. It looks absolutely fascinating. But first of all, tell us about the need. Why is there a need for what you're doing?
Everybody knows there's a crisis with housing supply in the country at the moment, Jamie. There are no affordable houses virtually being built. The government are not helping because the policies mitigate against that kind of building. Land supply and land prices mean it's developers not interested in doing that kind of thing, and nobody's putting their arm up the back to make them do it. In the meantime, average wages are falling, house prices are rising, right to buy is taking supply out of the market. Housing associations are up against it with the right to buy and housing benefit being cut and a cap being put on the amount of rent that they can charge, which goes against the agreement that was made, but that's another issue. People are in a desperate strait. People like Jordan here are coming out of university. My own son is 12 now. Guys like these and girls are not, they're looking to a future where they're not going to be able to afford their own place to live, and that's whole generations in the future. Every policy that's going at the minute is pushing people towards having to rely on a rental sector, which is not reliable, where 35% of properties don't meet a habitable home standard. And there's, at the moment, there is just no viable alternative. Nobody seems to be looking on the commercial scale at a solution, and we've got one.
So creating a solution isn't just about creating homes for people to buy. It's about doing something about the rental system, in which rents are rising, in which, as you say, 35% of homes are actually not habitable, don't meet habitable standards, and in which people are being squeezed because of rising prices. Now, in Sheffield, how many houses do we need to be created to meet demand?
According to a recent council report, which proposes solutions on a number of things up to 2035, they're looking at 44,000 extra houses in the city that need to be built in the next 20 years.
And is that going to happen?
At the present rate, I think they're building 1,500 a year, so no, there's no way that's going to happen. And the houses that are being built, there are some eco homes, there are an amount of new homes, but they're not what you would call affordable. I think the cheapest new build at the moment, the two big developments up at Norfolk Park, the two bedroom homes up there start at about 160,000. So if you're in a rented property paying £500-600 a month rent and trying to save up a £40,000 deposit on your new house, it doesn't take much doing of mathematics to figure out that it's going to take you a long time without a relative dying or something like that, or a lottery win, to ever stand any chance of being able to afford even a starter home and get that first foot on the ladder.
So REACH, then, your vision here is all about creating an alternative solution in terms of homes that people can afford, but as well as being affordable and attainable, you're talking about fully specced out eco homes as well.
That's right.
So you're working on a pilot project, you're working on a prototype, if you like, that's up at Healy City Farm, well known by many of us here in Sheffield. And what does this prototype look like?
At the moment, it looks like a 40-foot, 9-foot, 6-high shipping container. It's bright orange, so people will be able to see it.
Pretty visible.
Yeah, it'll soon have REACH Homes logo painted on the side of it, so it'll stand out even more. And kind of firstly say how grateful we are to Healy City Farm and John LaCorney and his team for hosting us up there. At the side of the Alternative Energy Centre, which is absolutely brilliant, we're going to share a lot of technology and development as we go on. But it's a fantastically visible place. And we're looking forward to working on that over the next couple of 3 months. So I'm hoping to have that prototype done by the end of August so that people can come up and touch it and feel it and see how good you can actually turn out. It's going to be a one-bedroom just for space considerations, but the kind of finish and the kind of equipment that you can get into a house for the kind of price that we're talking about.
Well, tell us more about the finish and the equipment you'll have in it.
Yeah, we're aiming for as good a spec as we can possibly get for the money, so we're not going to cut any corners. Because we're aiming for between 50% and 80% recycled materials, so the reduce costs of the material, help to keep the cost down. Part of what we do at Strictly Willow and our social enterprise model here is to train up apprentices and work experience people to do the work. So that helps to keep the costs down, and they'll be working alongside experts in the solar and insulation and plumbing and electrics to provide a real top quality home. Anybody who's Googled container homes on the internet, there are hundreds of good examples around the world. Very, very few in this country.
Why is that?
I think it's a perception thing. The first thing people say when you say we're doing shipping container homes is, I don't want to live in a metal box. If you think about it, we all live in concrete or brick or wooden boxes at the moment. So it's really just a matter of showing people that a metal space is no different. People think it'll get hot in the summer and cold in the winter, but we're going to insulate it to the and use techniques that are used in Germany and Scandinavia to make sure that doesn't happen. It's all going to be climate controlled. In fact, the climate in these houses should be healthier and nicer to live in than existing homes, because they're going to be mechanically ventilated with a heat exchanger, so that sucks all the moist, stale air out and then heats up fresh air coming back in. We're going to insulate them to a standard called passive house, which is extensively used in Germany and Scandinavia, where it's very heavily insulated building envelope. It stops the heat transmission to the outside, which also helps to cut your domestic bills by up to 80%. It's another bonus. We're looking to get all the properties certified to a variety of standards, of which passive house is one. So these really are going to be top quality homes, and all we're doing is we're taking all the flabby bits out of the existing building process. We're taking the heavily labour intensive bits out. We're taking a lot of the block work and material supply costs out, and shaving it down as much as we can. We're a not-for-profit business. We're not looking to make a huge amount of money out of this. Although, having said that, I've got a financial plan heading forward over the next 5 or 6 years, which means that by phase five of the project, which should be about 18 months, 2 years, we'll be able to buy land at commercial rate and then sell the houses with the freehold. By phase seven, which is probably going to be 3 years or so, we'll be able to provide financed properties, so people won't have to go cap in hand to the banks. And we'll also be able to look at the social housing market, which again is being decimated at the moment. Social housing supply is drying up because of the right to buy and the squeeze that's being put on housing associations. People just can't afford affordable places to live, so that's why we've come up with this scheme.
So that's an absolutely fascinating phased rollout that you have there, where you are looking to generate a surplus that enables you to ultimately provide affordable housing in a social housing model as well. So you need to be creating the income. Now, really interesting how you get from prototype stage to phase five and phase seven that you've just talked about. What's between prototype and phase five, and how do you get there? How do you get sufficient income coming in to get there? What are you dependent on? What are the challenges?
Right, the big sticking point at the moment, obviously, is land supply, and that's always going to be an issue, particularly in an area like Sheffield, which is bordered by the Peak District on one side, obviously, and other authority boundaries on the other. So there is a limited amount of land to use. Having said that, there's a lot of brownfield land in Sheffield, which we're looking to redevelop. There are a lot of sites where, because of the versatility of the containers that we're using, we can put them in places where you wouldn't contemplate doing a traditional build. So Jordan's been helping me out identifying some of those sites around town. I've got a meeting with the councillor in charge of infrastructure in a couple of weeks' time, and we're going to be discussing options to take it forward. And I know John Mothersong, the CEO of the council, is also personally interested in finding a solution to this and talking to us. So I've tried to create a public consensus to start with, and the Voom thing has been absolutely brilliant in doing that, because it's got the message out to thousands and thousands of people, and I'm being approached on a daily basis by people who've heard about it, who are encouraging us, who are saying, this is desperately needed, please go ahead, and how can we help? And you know, I've also been snowed under with offers of help from experts, from volunteers, from people who want to buy the houses. We've got a long waiting list already of potential clients. I know we can sell them. The market is there, and people are absolutely gagging for the chance to be able to own their own home. It's, you know, I'm I don't believe in that, those kind of Thatcherite policies of property ownership being the key to anything. I just think people have a basic human right. If they want to be able to afford a house, then they should be able to have it and not be forced to live in rented property, and give their money to people who, let's face it, if they can afford to rent out property, have already got enough money, and should be sharing that around and giving other people a chance.
So demands there. Jordan, you're nodding here clearly.
Yeah.
But also a willingness to be involved and to support the project is there. You're getting massive offers of help. And it sounds as though you have institutions on your side to a certain extent. Land supply is a challenge, as you've mentioned, but identifying appropriate brownfield land unsuitable for traditional development, unused, and in need of an exciting new life is clearly where you're looking. Now, Jordan, you're looking, you're helping,
yes,
with this as a volunteer in the project. What first got you excited about it?
Well, firstly, I kind of came down and wound up having a bit of a chat to John, and we got onto common ground about the project. And hearing about it really excited me for a couple of reasons. Firstly, at my age, just leaving university, the chances of being able to own anything within the next few years are very, very slim. It's a really tough world out there for people currently leaving with an awful lot of debt, and then massive house prices and hugely inflated cost of land as well. Just having those bills that go out every single month can be really damaging.
Indeed. And from your point of view, I mean, you've seen this firsthand with student accommodation.
Oh, yes.
but not meeting remotely environmental standards.
Yeah, a lot of houses, especially, I mean, we got quite lucky this year because we went into a newly renovated house, although it has cost a lot to do it. But in previous years, just freezing cold houses, rubbish heating, just holes in bits of the walls and stuff, like things that you wouldn't really think about, damp. And I've seen a lot of things and heard a lot from other students about their experience while here. And the housing situation is really quite dire at times. And
yes,
if someone has something, they will rent it as is to make a quick buck, rather than going through the necessary steps, because it isn't their problem. They're still going to make money because the demand is so high.
Yeah, and yeah, you're showing that you can do it at a very reasonable cost in terms of, you know, prototype now, but then when you go out to market, you're talking 1,200 square foot unit, 65,000 as a basic cost before, you know, adding on bells and whistles. This doesn't include the cost of land, but this is a house that's of a good size with phenomenal environmental standards. And
yeah,
passive house.
Easily extendable as well. If somebody wants another bedroom, they can just ring me up and say, we'd like another bedroom, and we'll just prep one up and take it to them 3-4 weeks.
And supply of containers won't be a problem.
Yeah, the construction process is clean, quick, less disruption for the neighbours because it arrives ready done. Cuts down on your carbon miles with all your deliveries to and fro. It makes project management a lot easier. And I don't see any reason why in 5 years' time we shouldn't have a yard in every city in the country. I mean, I'm sure people are going to come along and try and copy it, but they're not going to touch us on price.
Yeah.
Because we've got the social enterprise model, and we've got the using the recycled materials. And I know sorting the logistics out for that's going to be a nightmare, but there's so much stuff gets chucked away. I've just had all the trimmings off the roof of the mosque that they're redoing down on Wolseley Road. It's 200 mil thick king span. That stuff goes for about 60, 70 quid a sheet if you're buying it retail. We've got enough there to clad the whole of the bottom of a 40-foot container, which is going to save all the heat going out of the bottom, and that's just stuff that would have been landfilled.
And you're talking about most of the material being used on the house being recycled?
Well, 50 to 80%, yeah. That's going to include the container, because we've got to count the container as recycled material.
Yeah.
But yeah, the only things we're probably going to have to buy are the things like composting toilets and the MVHR pumps and the solar panels and technical bits. But I'll recycle them if we can. Because there are plenty that are coming back into the system now, because people are replacing and upgrading.
Yes.
So we can still reuse those. We can feed, like we do with Strip at the minute, we can feed stuff into other projects. If we can't use it, we can still put it into district heating projects. They're looking at doing one down on Washington Road, a big one on top of the flats down there, which will provide enough solar energy to hopefully heat most of the flats down there. And we, you know, we can feed into that. We can do R&D for people. We can bring on new technology. We're working with some big name suppliers like PGK Solar in Nottingham. They're one of the biggest importers in the country, and they're giving us the solar system at cost for the prototype. People are really, really excited about the fact that we're doing this a different way, and that, you know, that we're trying to really make a difference. And they can see that, you know, the sums add up, the logistics add up, the idea adds up, and the supply and demand adds up. It's a, I'd call it a perfect storm because that's a bit negative, but it's a perfect, like, virtuous spiral of stuff that's just going to feed off itself and really take on a life of its own, I think.
And as a social enterprise, it's going to earn its income. That allows you to reinvest in this and go from phase.
It's going to create loads of jobs. It's going to create loads of opportunities for people. The people that come in on the apprenticeships and work experience, I'm still thinking this through on the fly, but you know, they can earn credits towards getting their own home. You know, so instead of having long-term unemployed people without any prospects, they can come and learn basic skills through us and maybe end up, you know, with a home themselves. And I don't know how it'll fit into housing budgets, shrinking housing benefit budgets and things like that, but I don't see any reason why people shouldn't get a leg up on the ladder through that, to give them the self-reliance and self-confidence to go off on their own rather than having to rely on the social sector all the time.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, it's shrinking and the supply is not there, and councils are up against it with the financial side of administering those kind of schemes. That's something where I think the market will eventually sort itself out, but it needs us at the bottom stoking it to make that happen and to provide those opportunities.
Great. I just want to ask you again about where you've had social enterprise support and where you've had and the difference that Voom's made for you. So can you just tell me that again?
Right, well, Voom, it's been a fantastic profile raiser. There's so many people know of us and what we're doing now and know about the project. So they know there's something credible out there. But I've also had support from, obviously, Ely City Farm. We've had the funding from Unlimited already and the backup from Unlimited. We've just been accepted onto Business in the Community's Art Programme, which is 12 months of business support. I've got to do a video interview because I can't go to the actual live pitch on Tuesday now with the School for Social Entrepreneurs for the scale-up. Scale-up scheme. I've just done just finished the startup and graduated from that. So amazing support from them. The support from the team here and the volunteers here at Strip has been, I mean, I wouldn't be in a position to do it if it hadn't been for all the people who've put time and effort in over the last 2.5 years to keep this place going. All the people who've donated us stuff and bought stuff from us and just taken us to their hearts, really, because this was a mad idea 2.5 years ago, and we were sat with a finger in the air wondering if it would work and if we could get £40 a day off customers to keep it going. And, you know,
what are you up to now?
We're paying quite a few wages. I've just taken on a chap who's been with me on, he's just done 6 months work experience from Groundwork. I'm just taking him on, so we are doing exactly what we said we were going to do when we opened up. We're just doing it I'm so quicker than we ever thought we were going to be able to.
Is social enterprise thriving in Sheffield?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm the secretary of the Social Enterprise Network, and as you know, and you know from meetings down at Union Street and so on, there's a fantastic strength in depth of lots of very clever, motivated, passionate people doing a lot of really good things. We're trying to bring that together and stoke it and get the council on board with it and find out what the social enterprise landscape is in Sheffield, because we don't even know that at the moment. We're trying to get Sheffield noticed as a social enterprise place through Social Enterprise UK. We're working with the people in Manchester to try and take that bid forward. Unlimited have just offered us a very generous pot of money as an accelerator for social enterprise, which we're hoping to be administering through the enterprise network to members in the autumn. It's a very, very exciting sector to be in, and I think it really is the future of driving the economy forward, because they're ethical businesses who are doing things that need to be done the right way, and they're listening to the people who need the things doing for them. They're not just putting something in place and it being a one-size-fits-all solution. They're tailored solutions to real-life problems. That's why I love it so much, because it's really responsive to what people need, and it's not just some accountant's idea of how it should work and then all the money gets taken out of the system and taken out of the city and put in somebody's bank account in this country or Panama. As Jordan says, it's local money for local people, and it keeps the wheels turning. Money to me, I'm not interested in making money out of it. I don't want paying for this. I just want to be able to make a difference. And money's just another tool to make it happen. It shouldn't be the be all and end all of what everybody is striving for. It's far more important that we care for each other and make sure that everybody's happy and comfortable and has got a good standard of living. And that's coming from somebody who spent 26 years in the police service thinking that he was doing everything the right way. And I've wake up, people. We need to change the way we're doing things.
So, John, trying to change the world and achieving that with Strip the Willow, looking to achieve that with Reach Co-Housing, and a project that certainly meets a very defined, well-documented need for affordable housing, for access to housing, and a need for houses to reduce their environmental impact too. And all the best with the project, John. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jamie. Cheers.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. We're broadcasting from the Sheffield Live radio studio in the centre of Sheffield on FM radio and online. The show is also available as a podcast from the Sheffield Live website. And on the programme today, Jay Biani has been talking about changes to employment law and what you need to know about if you're an employer, if you work with people as employees, if you hire self-employed contractors or workers. Now, the law continues to evolve. You need to know what's going on. Listen to Jay's interview. If you've only just tuned in, catch it on the podcast later. She came into the Sheffield Live radio studio on Wednesday of this week to run through the latest changes, and she comes in every few weeks to do that for us. Also on the programme today, we've just heard an interview with John Johnson. He's set up Reach Homes. Now, I interviewed John last year, in June last year. So the interview that we've just played was from June 2016. And since then, he's developed his prototype for affordable housing made from shipping containers and using mainly recycled materials. And John won one of the awards at the Sheffield Business Awards last night, Thursday, the 7th of December, the award ceremony at Ponds Forge. And he'd entered the awards, but he was clearly shocked to win, shocked and emotional, gave a very emotional speech about the progress made so far and what needs to happen with his project at the Sheffield Business Awards last night. So I thought it was a timely moment to play that interview with John from 2016 to remind us of what his aspirations are for Reach Homes and how he wants to make the project progress. If you've only just tuned in, then panic not. The podcast of today's programme will be up on the Sheffield Live website from about 11 o'clock today, talking about podcasts. Last week's show is there. We had a really great interview with Gillian Kowalczyk. She's set up Safe and the City, fascinating project, and she's overlaying data with on maps so that you can look at what people say are environmental factors in terms of feeling safe in a city, starting in London, but she wants to expand to other cities, including Sheffield. So if you miss that, it's on the Sheffield Live website. Also, in last week's programme, we had Charles and Ben talking about a mentor-mentee relationship, positive process of mentoring and how it works for Ben and how it's helped his career. So take a look. Have a listen. When you're up on this Sheffield Live website, there's plenty of other things to see, of course. There are news clips from the evening news programme, and you could watch Sheffield Live's new TV show, the Who, What, Where show. That's launched with a Kyle Walker special. The Sheffielder and England International was on the first episode. Second episode featured Craig David, and the third episode featured Adam Duffy and Judd Trump. Those are all on the Sheffield Live website. Plenty of other material there for you to enjoy. And do you want to get in touch? Do you want to be on this programme? Do you want to be on Business Live? Is your business or social enterprise doing something fantastic, innovative, different? do you feel that you should talk about it? Well, get in touch. Send an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Text 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Whether you're starting, whether you're running a business or a social enterprise, whether you're an employer, whether you're an employee, we're always really keen to hear from you. So get in touch, put yourself forward, put someone else forward to be on the programme, or simply send us a note about your with your comments on what's going on and how they affect your business. Really keen to hear from you, so do get in touch. That's about it for today, but don't go away now, because next up, it's our fantastic folk music programme. Thank goodness it's folk, from 10 all the way through to noon. So do stay tuned for that. We'll be back on air next Friday, so tune in then. And thanks so much to Jay Bayani for coming into the studio on Wednesday to give us an update of what was going on. Thanks for going on in employment law. Thanks also to you for listening. And thanks to Sangeeta in the studio as sound engineer. We'll play out with Neil McSweeney and the gents, London Road.